money advice you can depend on. Weekdays with Clark Howard and Dave Ramsey, and midday every Sunday with Elise Glake on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Or rather, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome back to the Elise Glink Show. It is the day before Halloween. What a spooky and scary day. I was just perusing some of the celebrity costumes that people came up with. The Daily Mail, which is a British publication, actually covers U.S. celebrities even better than the U.S. publications do. And they were showing pictures of Heidi Klum and other, I don't know, the costumes are unbelievable. I don't know who's designing them out there in Hollywood, but it's like Lady Gaga on steroids. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. We are online all the time. The website is thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. Don't forget to check out the Equifax Finance blog. We have all kinds of really good information there. And I'm realizing that this is our last Sunday in October, so we're going into November, and I think what I'm going to do is over the next couple of weekends, we'll reach out to our tax experts and see if they'd like to come on the show. We usually do a couple of tax, you know, getting getting your finances ready for the end of the year with some tax tips. So we're going to do that and have those guys come back. I have a few thoughts on that today as well. And I wanted to talk a little bit about it's big news week again. And, of course, we're taking your calls, 404-872-0750. I mean, first the numbers. Dow was up 422 points this week, ending at 12,231. I can't remember the last time we were above 11, you know, we hit 12,000, so I don't know. It was a while ago, if I can't remember, maybe earlier this year before we took this big deep dive. And the reason that the Dow went up is that there's all this euphoria over the Eurozone deal. And Nicolas Sarkozy, who's the French president, said that if Greece had gone bankrupt, there would have been a domino effect, the entire Eurozone risk being taken down. And apparently in the 14th summit in 21 weeks, I think that's how short a time it's been, 21 months maybe, 14 Eurozone summits, Angela Merkel, who is Germany's chancellor, basically said to the banks, if you don't agree to a 50% haircut, in other words, if you don't take a 50% hit on your debt, we will let you go down in flames and we will blame you. So the banks blinked, and they said, okay, we're gonna take that hit. But, you know, the idea is that, oh, Greece isn't defaulting. Greece is defaulting, right? Greece is defaulting. They're just calling it something else. And my concern is that this isn't really going to solve much. Now, part of the deal is that Greece is supposed to get to 120% of its debt. Right now, it's got debt that's 170% of its annual GDP, right? I believe it's 170%. They're trying to get to 120% by the year 2020, so in about 8 years. That is a very short period of time. I don't think there are a whole lot of economists who think they're going to get there. And there are other problems in the Eurozone where people are actually, countries are actually in higher amounts of debt even than that. But the region's bailout fund is now going to go to $1.5 trillion. We talked about that number a long time ago. I can't even remember. A few months ago, I was saying that there had been some rumors about how it might be $3 trillion. They've agreed on $1.5 trillion. The bondholders are going to take a 50% write-down. There will be a compulsory increase of bank capital by $106 billion. Nobody knows, by the way, where that money's going to come from. Maybe China. I don't know. And the euro strengthened, and the stock markets all got a good kick, and we went up 422 points. And I guess we're just going to have to see. But this, you know, this month, the Dow is on its best monthly percentage gain since October of 1974. 73, 74, as you'll remember, was sort of two big recession years. The real question is, and then we got the good news, the bonus good news, that the U.S. economy grew 2.5% in the third quarter, a rebound from the second quarter's 1.3%, and they said that everybody was spending money. And here's my take on that. How could everybody be spending money unless we're doing more credit card debt, which we are, or we are spending down our savings, which we are? It's not like incomes are increasing. Incomes increased by 0.1%. It's about the lowest it's been in 20-odd years. And people just can't manufacture money. Only banks and countries seem to be able to manufacture money. I personally do not have a money tree in my backyard. And if you do, I hope you'll give me a cutting of it. But maybe then Walter can make it grow for all of us. But, you know, this idea that you can just manufacture money out of nowhere is just, I think, a very serious concern. I just don't see that being the great big solution. So we'll see how everybody, now that some of the details, or when the details get revealed, because of course all we saw were big broad strokes. So now somebody's got to go in and actually invent this thing and figure out a timetable to make it work. I guess we're just going to wait and see what happens. I'm not all that hopeful, but we'll see. 404-872-0750. We're going to talk about taxes in a little bit. Mortgages. I'm happy to answer what I know about the new HARP program, a home affordable refinance program that President Obama announced last Monday. We told you we thought it was coming. It did come on Monday in Las Vegas, which is ground zero of what's been going on in the housing crisis. So, you know, happy to take questions about that as well. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Let's go to the phones. Kimberly joins us on the line from Marietta. Hey, Kimberly.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm calling today because our mother, well, actually she's not really our mother, but she's like the community mother. She's actually a nanny for several of us in the community, and she keeps our children in her home.
Okay.
She's having trouble with her mortgage. She financed her mortgage some years ago, and then she financed through a loan company, as I understand it. However, this company went out of business, so where the government comes in and takes over. And so now she's making payments. She's got perfect credit. She's never missed a payment. But we don't know who owns the loan. So there's one company who's servicing her loan, who she's making payments to. But since the lender of the loan went under, we don't know who owns the loan.
Okay, let's stop for a minute because I want to understand. Did she, when you say she got financed through a loan company, did she get financed through a bank?
No, it's my understanding it was a
mortgage company?
Yeah, I guess.
Who's servicing her loan right now?
It's called OCWEN.
Ocwen. Okay. Ocwen is one of the largest mortgage servicing companies in the country.
Okay.
It is highly regulated on a federal and state level.
Okay.
And it sounds like they are probably servicing it on behalf of one of the big, probably an investment pool, but it's probably, is it a Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or FHA loan?
That I don't know. The company that went out of business was First NLC Financial Services.
Okay.
Around 2008.
But they didn't hold on to the loan.
Right.
So they probably did the loan. They were probably a mortgage brokerage firm. They didn't hold on to the loan. They resold it.
Yes.
So they probably resold it to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac since they were buying 98% of the, you know, the regular mortgages, the conventional mortgages.
Okay.
So they probably sold it. Ocwen got it, and Ocwen is servicing it. So has she called Ocwen?
Yes, but every time we call them, their phones are in another country, and we can't get a straight answer as to who owns the loan. They seem to not understand that question.
Okay, and why does she need to know who owns the loan?
Well, she wants to get it refinanced. She can't really afford the loan right now. Plus, the value of what her home is falling, you know, tremendously, and she's hoping to, you know, get someone to refinance her based on the current value of the loan.
Okay. Is her home underwater? Is her home worth less than the amount of the mortgage?
Yes.
Okay. So one thing that she can do, you can get the loan number for her from her, and you can go to Fannie Mae, FannieMae.com or FreddieMac.com, and you can put the loan number into those websites, and they will tell you whether the loan is Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac.
Oh, okay. Great.
Then, if it's one of those, she may qualify for this new home affordable refinance program that allows people who are underwater with their mortgages to refinance. Do you know how far underwater she is?
No, I don't.
That would be an important thing for her to find out.
Okay.
So
would you pay for an appraisal?
No, don't pay for anything.
Okay.
What she should do is call a couple of the mortgage. You or she can look up addresses of homes that have recently sold and probably find out how much they sold for. Or you can call a local real estate agent and ask somebody to help you.
Okay.
Right? Or you can even look it up, usually online.
Okay.
So just kind of get a sense. Like if you've got 10 foreclosures in the neighborhood and they're all selling at 20 cents on the dollar, she's probably pretty far underwater.
Okay.
Okay.
Got it.
Once you figure out how much she's underwater, who owns the loan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you can go to a lender and figure out how it's going to work to refinance. And
okay.
See if she qualifies for this new program. Now, the program won't really start until December 1st, and if she's way underwater, it's not going to start until January or February.
Well, that's fine. She's never missed a payment, and she has A1 credit.
Good. She should continue to not miss payments and have A1 credit. Don't miss any payments between now and the time that she tries to apply for this program, because it's only for people who are on time with their mortgages.
Oh, okay, perfect.
So yes. Do not, I don't care if somebody tells you have to be 3 months late or this or that's qualified, don't listen to them.
Okay.
She should continue paying the mortgage on time and in full until she gets qualified for this program.
Okay, perfect.
Now, if she doesn't have, if she cannot find out, let's say it's not Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, and let's say it's not FHA, right? Then what she's going to have to do is she can call the Georgia Department of Banking and Finance and talk to the ombudsman there and say, look, we're having trouble with Ocwen, and we need you to step in and help us find out who actually owns this loan. They're not responding to us.
Oh, okay, got it.
All right, so these are some steps. So you take those steps with her this week.
Okay.
Try and figure it out. You can call back next week or send me an email at thinklink.com, and we'll talk about next steps.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much,
Lisa. Oh, you're welcome, Kimberly. I'm so glad that I could help a little bit. And hopefully this woman who's like the neighborhood grandma is going to get her mortgage in order. 20 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. We have loads more coming up. We're going to start talking about tax. There was the whole thing about what's going to happen with student loans and maybe being able to refinance those, or at least consolidate those at today's low interest rates. That's all very exciting. So stay tuned for more on AM 750, now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinklink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
Five minutes past the hour on a scary Elise Klink show. Ooh. Halloween's tomorrow. It's so exciting. My kids don't want to be anything. I said to Michael, "What? You're 13. Don't you want to go out trick-or-treating?" He goes, "Well, I want the candy. I'll probably just throw on a sports jersey and go out with my friends." Alex always has, a couple of years ago when he decided he didn't want to go trick-or-treating anymore, he invented this trick where kids come to the door and he offers them a huge bowl of vegetables, like carrots and celery and onions, like broccoli. It's like trick-or-treat. And he's gotten kind of known for it. So today, this afternoon after the show, I'm going to go out and buy a lot of vegetables for him so he can do his annual trick-or-treat. And then, of course, we have, you know, two massive Costco-sized bags of candy that we'll be handing out. And then our friends and I are going to just, I don't know what we're going to do, wander the streets. Our children are all too old for us. I don't know, maybe we'll get dressed up. This year we don't have a Halloween party to go to. We've been out of town in California all week. We were visiting Stanford. My older son Alex is interested in a program that they have next summer. And it was interesting to see. We did a tour. We were sitting through it, and they get to the financial part of it. And a year at Stanford now costs $60,000. And they said 80% of the students who go there, they're admitted need blind, right? But they get some sort of financial aid. And I was thinking to myself, $60,000 when Alex is ready in a couple of years to go, you know, if he gets lucky enough to get in, it'll be about $70,000. Well, my shock wasn't alone because the College Board report this week found a disturbing increase in the annual cost of four-year U.S. universities. The average rise in tuition and fees at public universities, 8.3%. I mean, we have no inflation in this country. The average cost of 1 year at a public university, $8,200. Total public university costs with room and board, over $17,000. 4.5% increase in the average total cost at private four-year nonprofit colleges this year. And total private college cost with room and board, $38,500. And Stanford's like almost twice that. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glink. Come on back. We'll be here with a scary Elise Glink show. News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live and new to guide you through your money and real estate questions only on AM 750. And now, 95.5 FM. News Talk WSB.
Six minutes past the hour, October 30th, day before Halloween. So glad you could join us here on the Elise Glink Scary Show. 404-872-0750. Actually, the only thing scary about today's show is the state of the economy. But, you know, it's been like that for a while. 1-800-WSB-TALK, online all the time. ThinkGlink.com. So we were talking just before the break about how expensive college has gotten. We saw the numbers the College Board report released this week. Found that the average rise in tuition and fees at public universities was 8.3%. This in an era of 0%, basically 1 to 0% inflation. And then the total cost of a private college has gone to over $38,000, including room and board, and total public university costs with room and board, $17,000 plus. But that's just an average, and it's more in other places. This week, Obama traveled to Colorado, to Denver, and talked about a plan to allow some students to combine federally backed loans with direct federal loans, while at the same time knocking as much as a half a point off the interest rate. So that's a big part of what he's doing. Then he also will allow some students to cap their monthly student loan payments at 10% of their disposable income, down from 15% in the current program, and allow a loan forgiveness. I actually didn't know that these loans were forgiven after 25 years, but apparently now they are, and he would push that to 20 years. He wants the plan to go into effect at the start of next year, in 2012, 2 years earlier than scheduled, which he said would make college more affordable and get more money moving into the economy. It's very interesting. We have 404-872-0750. Roger joins us on the line. So, Roger, you read an article about why tuition is climbing?
I did, and it was in the Wall Street Journal 2 or 3 months ago, and I'm going to butcher some of the statistics, but they're directionally accurate. This guy had written it using the University of Texas as an example, but he said that something about 90-something percent of the undergraduates were taught by about 10% of the professors.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most of the professors were not teaching undergraduate classes at all. And he said that if every single professor taught only 40 hours a month, not a week, but 40 hours a month, that the cost of an undergraduate education would decline by more than 50% overnight.
Wow.
And then he went on to kind of refute the argument that the academics would have that, you know, their real purpose is to be researchers and to write peer-reviewed articles. And he said that in the last 20 years, there had been over 15,000 new articles in peer-reviewed journals on Shakespeare. And he wasn't suggesting that we didn't need new research and articles on Shakespeare. But what he did say is maybe we could have gotten away with 1,500 instead of 15,000 articles on Shakespeare in the last 20 years. And, you know, if you look at the rising cost of education, they are solely caused by research and articles that are only consumed by other academics. It's absolutely ridiculous.
So, Roger, you bring up a really interesting point. And, you know, obviously the phone lines are open, folks. So if you want to call in and talk about this, 404-872-0750. So one of the questions that came up in this tour of Stanford that we were is what percentage of classes are actually taught by professors as opposed to TAs?
Right.
And they said that at Stanford, and I know this is not, you know, maybe this is sort of the case, but at larger universities, but that Stanford, most of the professors were teaching, and most of them preferred smaller classes. And so the reason that Stanford hasn't grown exponentially and they limit their class size to 1,700 for the whole grade is that the professors don't really want to teach 150-person sections. Now, when I went to the University of Illinois, my whole freshman year, I was taking classes with 300 to 500 kids in them. The professor lectured, you know, three times a week for an hour, and then you only ever interacted with TAs, teaching assistants,
right.
A model that I still think is followed at many public universities and private universities. But there are, to your point, there are so many, the economics are completely backwards when it comes to this kind of thing, where professors are given full professorship, right, or tenure, as it's called,
right.
Based on the number of peer-reviewed articles that they write. That's a huge part of it. If you're writing books and peer-reviewed articles, then that means you're a real academic and you should be given tenure, which is something that's desperately sought after. And so you're busy doing exactly what you've said and what this article probably said. And I looked for it, by the way, on the Wall Street Journal website. I couldn't find it. But what they're doing is they're focusing on moving their own careers ahead at the expense of actually doing what we are paying for in our tuition, which is to teach our kids.
No, absolutely. And the leadership, particularly the large public universities, are in a catch-22 because if they try to take the focus, you know, away from the peer-reviewed articles and, you know, towards the children and the kids and the education, then they're punished by, you know, the ratings organizations.
The rankings, right.
So
the incentives are all backwards, aren't they?
They
incentives are ridiculous because I was thinking I would love, you know, what is the point of charging $60,000 a year for tuition and then giving 80% of the students who come a discount? Like, what is?
I agree.
I don't understand that to begin with. But then when you add in sort of these other issues and you think to yourself, and by the way, Stanford is the most beautiful campus, and I would like to go there. I would like to give up my radio show and all the work that I do, and I would just like to go and be a freshman.
Yeah, but that money's not going to keep that campus beautiful. I mean, those campuses, typically, a school like Stanford is going to have more money in endowments than they know what to do with, and
they do.
There's plenty of money to maintain the campus and even improve the campus and the endowments.
There has to be a way. There has to be a way to get these academics and I have to just say I don't think I'm smart enough about this to be able to make a difference. But there has to be a way to start to change the incentives, because if we want our kids to get a higher level and a higher level beyond that, education. So not just college, but if we want them to have graduate level experience, and we don't want them graduating with $50,000 to $100,000 in debt. Or if you're a doctor, it is possible that you could graduate and go into practice with $1 million in undergraduate and graduate school debt. $1 million.
Right.
So even if you earn, you can't then be a GP because they're only going to make $150,000 to $200,000. You can't have $1 million in debt and only $200,000 in income, right? That doesn't work. We know that because look at all the pay option ARM loans out there. We know that doesn't work. But if you want to have the future generations able to specialize and have this kind of economic incentive to go through without killing them with loans, we have to find a different way. And it's going to be interesting to see how that works out. But as I said, I don't know that I'm smart enough to fix that just yet.
And you talk about economic incentives. Also consider that, you know, the top earners who are already, you know, very highly taxed in our tax system, this is yet another hidden tax, is if you are earning the money, you're expected to pay those $60,000 annual tuition bills. If not earning the money, you get it, you know, you get it gratis. So it's just, you know, another hidden tax. It's out there.
Yeah, it is. It is really interesting. Roger, thank you so much. This is a really good call. I appreciate
it.
All right, 44 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. You want to join this conversation? Matt joins us on the line from Smyrna. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's going on?
I was just listening to the discussion on the rising cost of education, and I think it's our next
big bubble that we're going to face in education. And the reason is I see the parallels between the housing market, what the government did through, low interest rates that caused the housing bubble. It's the same thing we're seeing with student loans. And that's what's truly causing the cost to go up. I don't think it has anything to do with too many papers being written about Shakespeare or anything like that. The market should dictate, where people are spending their money.
Well, here's what's... Consider this, because I think that this is sort of an important thing that's a differentiator between the student loan bubble, and I agree there is one, and the housing bubble. If you go into bankruptcy, you can discharge your mortgage. When you go into bankruptcy, you cannot discharge your student loans, ever.
Yeah.
So, I don't it's interesting, and the reason the government did that was because it's risky to lend somebody $30,000 who has no credit history, right? There was no way for the banks to figure out whether or not you're ever going to pay that money back. And so in order to get the banks to lend that money, the government decided to make it illegal or to discharge that debt. So what happens if you can't repay these loans? You fall into a deep, dark credit hole. And
sure.
I'm not sure how that's ever going. You're ever going to come out of that because those loans just won't be discharged.
Yeah, I think the reason I think it's a bubble is because there aren't any jobs for these kids coming out of college. I mean, even when I got out, it was 6 years ago. There, people with $30,000, $40,000 in debt for a $40,000 job just doesn't add up. I think the culture, just as we did in real estate, pushed people that the key to wealth was through real estate. Well, we're doing the same thing with education. There's a lot of people that don't need to go to college. A lot of the most successful people that I know in my early 30s skipped college and started their own businesses.
Well, that's really an interesting point. So there, believe it or not, there's some people out in California who are starting to put together funds to fund students who decide not to go to college or take a two-year hiatus to start a business, and they're providing funding for that. Because they are also college dropouts. These are people who are like Zuckerman and Gates, and they all got into Harvard and decided after about 6 minutes they weren't going to go.
Yeah.
And so they have formed these kinds of funds, and they're starting to try and find businesses that they can fund and take a little piece of the action for really brilliant kids. But I got to tell you, I think most people are not able to do that. Most people need some sort of training. And if you look at the level of education of the typical college graduate, where their reading skills are really low, their math scores are really low, you start to think about how are these people going to make change, let alone, figure out a strategy for a business. So I wouldn't want to see it happening in mass, but I do think that the recreation of our economy will come on the backs of people who are willing to take risk and step out and try to do something new. 47 minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. Matt joins us on the line from Sandy Springs. Hey, Matt.
Hey there. How are you?
Good, thanks. You?
Thank you. I'm fine, thank you. I disagree with you all to some extent because I think the free market is doing just fine with education. Look, if Stanford couldn't fill up their freshman class with $50,000 a year people, they wouldn't be charging it. Part of the problems we're subsidizing with student loans and so forth that people now are not going to have to pay back and mine anywhere close to full, and that's pushing the price up further.
I'm sorry, why do you feel like they're not going to be paying it back in full? The Obama plan is you pay it back in full, but you're paying it at a lower interest rate.
Are you not paying 10% of your salary per year?
Yes, but you're still you're still supposed to be paying that off until you get to some level of forgiveness. But that's just not really spelled out yet. I'm not quite sure what that whole thing is.
Yeah.
My understanding is those loans were only forgiven if you went into public service or you did Teach for America. I mean, there's certain jobs that you can take, and they will forgive some of your student loans. But
may be the case, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but I do think that, that again, if you want to be a market force, free market person, then the colleges are charging exactly what they should be charging. And in other words, you could go to a state school if you don't have enough money. Go to a state school, get a good undergraduate education, but maybe not go to Stanford, maybe not go to UVA as out-of-state students.
Well, Matt, but let's talk about that for a minute, because you have a very unique situation here in Georgia. There is a unique situation where if you have a B or higher average, at the moment, you can go to college for free. Right?
Yes, ma'am.
That
yes,
doesn't
ma'am.
Happen. Yeah, that just doesn't happen in other states. So, for example, the premier school in Illinois, where I'm from, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, is now $25,000 or $26,000 a year for tuition, room, and board. There is no free option. And even if you
community colleges, smaller schools, Central Illinois states, sometimes like that,
they're not free.
No,
they're not free,
they're
not even that low cost. Illinois is a state that's broke, so they've actually been they're pretty broke. So that is a state that has been increasing these costs. So if you are, it depends very much where you are and where you're located. But I have to say, I don't think you can equate a community college with even a University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign or a Georgia Tech or Stanford.
About that.
So when you say, you know, because I'm all about, and I have recommended on this show, spending a year, if you really truly can't afford it, spending a year or two at the best community college you can find, and then transferring to a university for your degree. And I do think that that's an amazing thing, but I disagree that there needs to be an 8.5% increase per year in the cost of state colleges, and that is just an average.
But are
and
they
even
not
the college board
filling up their freshman classes every? Don't they have three applicants for every place?
They are filling.
Market?
You know what they are, but I'm not sure a public university needs to make a huge profit. And what a lot of these colleges are doing with this money, you know, we may need to rethink how people and how are getting charged and where we're going with this stuff. I just feel like it's maybe not well thought out, and I don't know that it's sustainable. 51 minutes past the hour on the Elise Klink Show. Don't forget to check out today's Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I will be back with more in just a moment on News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on. Weekdays with Clark Howard and Dave Ramsey. And midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on AM 750. And now, 95.5 FM. News Talk WSB.
I put a spell on you.
57 minutes past the hour. News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glink. Thanks for joining us today. We've been talking about student loans, 404-872-0750. Let's go back to the phones. Larry joins us on the line from Athens. Hi, Larry.
How you doing, ma'am?
Good, thank you. What's your question?
It really wasn't a question so much as just a statement. Just a few minutes ago, he's talking about how these loans become so overwhelming as we keep digging ourselves deeper into debt to get these college degrees. And I, along with my brother, are two people that are in that situation. I've had student loans. I graduated in 1995 with a bachelor's degree. And when I first graduated, I started paying on them. But the payment amounts were more than I could afford. And as I've tried to make my way through the workforce, there's times I had to defer because they had no other options for me. And that compounding interest has now made it to the point where I can't even begin to dig myself out of debt. And I have spoke to the keepers of the loan, which is the William D. Ford Agency, and I've asked them if you could just stop the compounding interest and let me start putting a dent in this massive bill. It'd be so helpful, and they can't do it. And it just keeps compounding, getting larger, which makes the required payments even higher, which makes it more unattainable for me.
It's really unfortunate, Larry, because when you're in a situation like this and the compounding interest is killing you, what ends up happening is it destroys the rest of your life. You know, every payment you don't make is a ding on your credit. That prevents you from getting other kinds of loans that you might need in your life, house loan, car loan, at any sort of affordable rate. And it really is a sort of a significant long-term problem, one that I'm not sure is going to be easily fixed. Thank you for sharing your story. 404-872-0750 is our number here on the station. Would love to have more of this conversation. I think it's really helpful, really valuable, and maybe we'll do some of that coming up next. Also, we're going to talk about some tax tips for the end of the year. It's 58 before the hour. I'm Elise Glink. Stay tuned. We'll be back with a whole nother hour on News Talk WSB.
Got a black magic woman.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
7 minutes past the hour. Thanks for joining us for another hour of the Elise Glink Show. 404-872-0750 online all the time. ThinkGlink.com. Don't forget to check out my scary Halloween stories on CBS Money Watch. Just go to MoneyWatch.com, click on my name, they will all pop up. And the Equifax Finance blog, where you'll find amazing information from real experts in the tax, insurance, investing, real estate, and credit areas. And we have real experts from Equifax's own credit staff who are there answering your credit questions. It's an amazing opportunity to get some one-on-one time with a credit expert if you want. 404-872-0750. Lynn has been holding for quite a while from Atlanta. Lynn, welcome to the program.
Hi, Elise. First of all, I want to thank you for your show. You are very informative, and I love your show.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I wanted to ask you, did you say that the student loans are supposed to be forgiven after 25 years, and is that in effect now, or is that something that they're talking about doing in the future?
Well, it's interesting. I kind of vaguely remembered this, and so I went back and looked, and there was something in 2007 called the College Cost Reduction and Access Act. And this established a new public service loan forgiveness program, and the program discharges any remaining debt after 10 years of full-time employment in public service. However, and here's a big however, the borrower must have made 120 payments, right, so 10 years of payments, as part of the Loan Direct program, and only payments made on or after October 1st of 2007 count towards the required 120 monthly payments. So it wouldn't even begin until 2017, really. Now, there was also a loan forgiveness of the remaining balance after 25 years of repayment for the income contingent and income-based repayment for those borrowers not fully employed in public service jobs. So who's eligible for public service loan forgiveness, right? The borrower...
So that would kind of limit it to cops and things like that.
Well, it's interesting. It excludes a member of Congress, but it includes emergency management, military service, public safety, law enforcement, so that's police and fire, public health, including nurses, nurse practitioners, nurses in a clinical setting, and full-time professionals engaged in health care practitioner occupations or support occupations, public education, early childhood education, so teachers, right, including licensed or regulated child care, Head Start, state-funded pre-kindergarten, social work in a public child or family service agency, public service for individuals with disabilities or the elderly, public interest legal services, including prosecutors, public defenders, legal advocacy on behalf of low-income people, librarians, school librarians, other school-based services, employees of a tax-exempt 501c3 organization, full-time faculty at tribal colleges and universities, and in high-need subject areas, and some other stuff. So it's actually a little more broad than police and fire.
Okay. My question, the reason I asked the question is because it's been 30 years since I borrowed $2,500.
Oh,
and
gosh.
Shortly after, I was thrown out of school for missing 2 days of it. And now I supposedly owe $45,000 in student loans, yet I became disabled 26 years ago. And my income is $674 a month. My rent is $500. And I every day receive probably 5 or 6 phone calls a day that I don't answer from people trying to collect on this student loan.
The fact that you could have a student loan of $2,500 that ballooned to $45,000 is unbelievable.
Right, and that's what I have been fighting with them over. They were supposed to discharge it because of disability, and somehow they messed up the paperwork, and it never went through. That was back in the 80s, and now that it has ballooned up this big, it's really irritating because when we supposedly were going to have this rebate from the federal government for like $250. They called it a stimulus.
Yeah.
I got a letter in the mail stating that I would not get one because I owed the federal government a student loan. And I thought to myself, if that is not such a slap in the face. And then to even make a further slap in the face, my daughter, who was attending a state Georgia college, was kicked out after she did not have another $3,000 for another semester of study. She already had borrowed $3,500. The second time that she needed more, no one would loan her the money on a student loan, so she got kicked out. And I finally told her, you know, there are 32 families in Virginia that probably wish their children had been kicked out of school. Don't worry about it. Maybe God has another plan.
Well,
and as it turns out, she got a full-time job and has already moved up to assistant manager and is making now more than she would if she had a degree.
Well, that's a good happy ending for your daughter. But let's focus on maybe what you have done. Do you still have any of your old paperwork?
Some of it, but I have been through 40 different what they would call acts of God that were similar to Katrina, and between them and not being able to make payments on my storage building, I've lost the majority of the things that were in the desk, but I do still have some of it.
You know, you can call Legal Aid of Georgia, which is an amazing organization. I met somebody, I was in, they're just an amazing organization. I would call them and ask them if they can help you get this discharged. It seems astonishing to me that this could have gone on as long as it has, and I don't know that you qualify for the discharge, but why don't we see? It seems like if you had filed suit when they were supposed to discharge it and they didn't, even in small claims court, it probably would have gotten taken care of. But it just seems to me that now would be a nice time to get this off your back. So why don't you call Legal Aid, see if they can help you with this. Hopefully they can. And if they can't, then we'll, you know, give us a call back, and we will try to figure out another resource for you that may be able to help. And that may be the Georgia Department of Banking and Finance or the Governor's Office of Consumer Affairs. I feel very strongly that there'll be somebody out there who will be able to help get this off of your back. And I'm sure it'll feel amazing to you. So let's work on that for this year. 15 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. Let's continue on with our calls. Ben joins us on the line from Cumming. Hey, Ben.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure thing, and thank you for holding. How can I help you today?
Yeah, I just had a quick question. Kind of switching gears on you here, but trying to save every dime I can for myself and friends in this economy. I have a friend who's applying for a job, and once they start working, it's in the restaurant industry, they realize at the end of the night, the restaurant is charging them 2.5% of their total credit card sales and taking that back. And I didn't know if that's something that they could do, if it was just greed.
Well, it's interesting, but that sounds about what they're being charged.
Yeah.
So credit card, so for example, let's say a check is $100. And the restaurant is only going to keep 97.5% of that, right? So let's say the tip is part of that, and they're only keeping 97.5%. They're just passing that on. There's no reason they should take the hit for your friend's tips.
Well, I mean, I feel if the company is going to offer the credit card option, that they should be taking on that cost, not the employees.
But they are for their own amount. They're not charging the employee. They're only charging him for the sales, the credit card tip.
No. They're actually charging you on total credit card sales. If you were to sell $1,000 in one evening and it was all on credit cards, you would be giving the restaurant back $25.
Yes, I understand. But what's happening is that so let's say there's a $100 bill, and of that, $20 of that is the tip.
Yes.
So the restaurant has to pay 2.5% on the $100.
Yes.
So that's fine. They're willing to take that hit for the food and the restaurant, you know, the restaurant itself, but they're not willing to pay the 2.5% for your friend's tip.
Okay.
So they're deducting the cost of processing the tip.
Okay.
Because otherwise they'd have to eat that, and that doesn't seem fair particularly.
Yeah, I see that point of view.
So I think that's what's happening, and I think it is legal. and 2.5%, as somebody who does take credit cards on my website for books and things like that, 2.5% seems not, you know, ridiculous.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I just never heard anybody say that before, and it kind of just sparked my interest a little
bit. Yeah, well, you know, we have so many people who own restaurants who listen to this show, and I'm sure that somebody will pick up the phone. If I'm wrong about this or think that it is out of line, somebody's going to call. In fact, I'm going to give the number right now, 404-872-0750, if you'd like to add to this conversation so Ben can help his friend out. 404-872-0750. We'll put you on the air. Thanks for your call, Ben. 17 minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. Let's continue on with our calls. Brandon joins us on the line. Hi, Brandon.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's going on?
I'll just backtrack a bit on the student loan issue. The reason why student loans, and not just with student loans, but the reason why college is so expensive nowadays, I originally come from California, and the average tuition there is about $27,000 for an in-state school. Now, the reason why it's so expensive is because government mandates and they subsidize school, like schools in general, like especially colleges and student loans and whatnot. So the banks, because they can't trust a high school kid going into college because he's got no job, he's never had a job, he's got no credit, line of credit, you know, the government came out with doing student loans. So the government, you didn't have a job, you had no line of credit, no trust, whatever. The government said, here's $30,000, go get an education. So they just were handing money out for free. And then in time, just like how when the government subsidizes everything, everything goes up like sugar, like, you know what I'm saying, like real sugar or whatever. But the main thing is to cut costs on colleges, you need to get the government out of everything that's mandated, everything that's subsidized, get the government out of it. Because, I mean, look at the 60s and the 70s. People could hold a job in the summertime, pay for their college, and be only in $300 in student loan debt and have a bachelor's degree. And then they would have a job waiting for them on the outside, and they go buy a home.
Nowadays, so, Brandon, the only problem with that theory and going back to, like, the 60s and 70s is a small fraction of Americans were going to college, and professors weren't earning $150,000 to $200,000 a year.
True.
So you have had inflation, and unfortunately, we have an unemployment crisis in this country, and for students, it's like 25 to 30% unemployment. Kids can't get jobs in the summer. So,
yeah.
You know, really, you know, it's lovely to think that, you know, we could just go back to the 60s and 70s and somehow taking the government out of it. I don't know what that means even, because you've always had public universities where the government gave them, it's tax-free and the government helped subsidize it because there's an interest in having our students be educated. I mean, it's like saying, oh, let's just not have a free grammar school or high school education for anybody. Let's just make that a free market system. There are things that we do in this country because it's in the public interest. And that's why government exists, to do things that the rest of us just can't do. And I'm sorry, but I can't get on the whole program of getting the government out of college is somehow going to lower the cost. I think our first caller had the right idea, you know, quoting from a Wall Street Journal article where Roger, who said that, you know, really it's the economics and the incentives are completely reversed. And you've got all these professors spending most of their time writing peer review articles so that they can all get tenure and prove how valuable they are so that the universities can go up in the rankings. That, I think, is a much bigger problem than the government having public subsidizing public universities. But, hey, that's just me. 21 minutes past the hour. We've got a prize pack to give away. We'll do that next. And I have to find some time to tell you what happened with that $5 debit fee from Bank of America. Chase back down this week. I'll tell you what Bank of America is doing coming up next. I'm Elise Glink. You're listening to News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live and new to guide you through your money and real estate questions only on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Minutes past the hour. It's time for our weekend WSB McDonald's prize pack. Today's value, $397. It includes a four-pack of tickets to see the Picasso to Warhol exhibition. That sounds great. Now through April 29th at the High Museum of Art, a gift certificate for a quick lube oil change courtesy of Bellamy Strickland, a McDonald's one-week breakfast prize pack, and a gift certificate for a full house plumbing inspection courtesy of Superior Plumbing. Fred is going to take your call if you are the fifth caller. Good luck to you. The prize pack line number 404-741-0750. Good luck. All right, we were talking about tipping and restaurants charging their servers 2.5%. Chris joins us on the line. Chris, what's your take?
I was just going to mention, and I'm kind of a cheapo, but merchants get charged anywhere from 3 to 5% on a transaction for a credit card transaction. An awards card, for example, where you get Sky Miles, the merchant subsidizes it. So, you know, they have to pay for the monthly maintenance fee for the machine. They have to pay a transaction fee, plus they have to pay a percentage according to which card they accept. So that's a legitimate, practice, I would think. But on the flip side of the coin, if you go to a merchant that accepts credit cards, ask for a discount if you pay with cash.
Ah.
Because you're going to be saving them anywhere from 2.5% to 5%. And I found that probably 75% of the time, they'll give it to you.
Wow.
You just got to ask.
That is an awesome tip, Chris, and you're going to save people some money today. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glink. More of your questions coming up next, and what Bank of America is doing with that $5 debit fee that's gone over like a sack of bricks. 28 minutes past the hour. I'm Elise Glink. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more on News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on. Weekdays with Clark Howard and Dave Ramsey, and midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
36 minutes past the hour. I hope you're going to have a great and safe Halloween tonight and tomorrow. I know in some communities they're celebrating today. This afternoon the kids are wandering around our community. Tomorrow is the official day. Thank gosh we're not out in the east where they've had like a foot of snow overnight. But a little chilly. Bundle up. Watch the kids. 404-872-0750. Following up on our conversation about tipping and what the appropriate charge is, Linda joins us on the line. Hey, Linda, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Elise. I enjoy your program.
Thank you.
I just wanted to comment on leaving the tips. I understand both points of view. Exactly. But if I go to a restaurant and have exceptional service and I happen to be charging my meal, I leave my tip in cash.
You do.
So the server will get 100% of benefit for their service.
Nice.
So well, I didn't know that for a long time, that they took out their tips when you charge your meal. And one time a server told me that, so I've started leaving tips in cash.
Well, it's the same thing with cab drivers, right? Because they also get charged, and they get charged sometimes even more, like as much as 10%. Because after you subtract all the car company fees and the cab fees itself, I mean, the cab drivers can get hit, 5% or higher. And that's why they always ask, were you paying cash? And unfortunately, because everything I do is tied, if I take a cab for business, I have to be able to prove that. And getting the receipts, they can get lost. I really have to track. I can't do it. I wish I could, but I can't. But giving the tip in cash is kind of a nice thinking. And hopefully more and more people, will think about that. But it's a great thing that you're doing, and thanks so much for sharing. 404-872-0750, which, interestingly enough, brings me to my next point, which is the debit cards. I wanted to go back to this. So Bank of America announced a couple of weeks ago that it was going to be charging $5 a month if you use your debit card. And that's almost 38 million people have a Bank of America debit card. And so they were going to charge them because of actually the fees that are being slashed. So these merchant fees that you've been hearing Congress and said, we can't make it. The credit card companies are charging us more and more on these merchant service fees, and we just can't swing it. And so Congress stepped in and sliced that and limited the amount that merchants can get charged. So what happened? Bank of America turned around. All the big banks were doing this, and they started testing a $5 debit fee for every month that you charge it, because they're like, well, we still want to make profits, and we're limited on some kinds of fees, but we could still charge a debit fee. Well, there's been such a massive, massive outrage about this that Chase, which had been testing a 3% debit fee, is coming forward to say that they are not going to be charging that. And now it looks like Bank of America is going to try and find a way to not charge it as well, or make it so that you can get out of it. So more people, if you're smart and you're sophisticated about what you're doing, you're going to get out, being able to get out of that $5 fee too. And they may rescind it entirely altogether. We don't have any official word yet. But this is the, these are some of the early reports that the media are saying, is that they are going to not go forward with this in the same version that it was announced. And very interesting enough, of course, we'll be following this for you, but I wouldn't be surprised if this week we hear something else come out from the big banks about these debit fees and what they're going to do instead. 404-872-0750 is our number. It's 40 minutes past the hour. Jim's been hanging on for quite a while from Alpharetta. Hi, Jim. Thank you for holding.
Hey, Elise. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What can I do for you today?
Well, let me set the table for you. My wife and I refied last year, got a great deal, 30-year fix, 4.375.
Nice.
So, yeah, it reduced our payments by about over $400 a month. So we're in good shape. No complaints there. But I'm a vet, and I've noticed recently that the VA is giving loans, you know, at possibly lower interest rates. And then, even then, the lower interest rate may be at like a 15-year or a 20-year. But it says zero down on them. And I haven't checked into any of them yet, but I just wondered if it really is zero down, I guess, and if there's any
The short answer is yes. The Veterans Administration does offer zero down loans for veterans who qualify. And thank you for your service, by the way. But I think there's a little bit more to it than you might imagine. First of all, you have a 4.375% loan. Your VA loan is going to be at a higher interest rate, most likely. And they only do the zero loans, the zero down loans, for people who are willing to pay tremendous fees and costs. They really don't want you to do a zero down loan. And so the fees are lessened as the down payment is increased. So you were able to refinance. I assume you have equity in the property, right?
A little bit, not as much as we'd like, but yeah.
Okay. So there, unless you're buying a new property, and you can only have one VA loan at a time, there would be no reason for you to use that program. That program's not going to benefit you at all.
What I was wondering.
Yeah. The next move for you would be to trade in your 4.375% loan, if you could swing it, for a 15-year or a 10-year loan. And
That's where it gets tricky.
Yeah, you'd probably have to do some sort of a bigger, you'd probably have to pay for a whole new refinance, which would be expensive. But you'd only do this if you could, you could lower your interest rate by a point, 1% to like 3.25%, or even 3% for these 10-year loans. And it, you know, if costs may be a problem, you're much better off taking the extra $400 a month that you now have and just sort of socking it away into a savings program. I mean, 4.375 is a historically amazing rate.
Yeah, we missed the bottom out. I think it bottomed out last year like 4.16, so we felt like we did pretty good.
You know what? Let me just say something about trying to time the mortgage market. It almost never works, and it could be that mortgage interest rates will go down again. And I would just say that, you know, as I tell this, 2 years ago, I finally refinanced out of a 5-1 adjustable into a 15-year at 4.25. And I thought, that is the most amazing rate I'm ever going to get. And then rates dropped. And so a year ago, I refinanced to a new 15-year mortgage at 3.75. And I took a slightly higher interest rate because I didn't want to pay that much. So I took, you know, I could have had 3.5, but I took 3.75 because I just didn't want to pay that much out of pocket. And just that last week, we refinanced again to a new 15-year loan at 3.25% or 3.375 or something like that. And again, we took a slightly higher rate because we didn't want to pay that much out of pocket. And so I'm continuing to make my same former payments, so I'll pay this loan off in 11 or 12 years. But you're never, the point is, even me, the real estate expert, right, even me, you don't always hit the lowest, right? The goal is to not try and time the market. The goal is to just watch what's going on and try to get what is an improved deal for you. And it sounds like you did that.
Well, quite frankly, we just happened to fall into a lucky time frame where we got the 4.375. So, we weren't trying to time the market or anything, really. We knew we were going to get somewhere down where we got, but we didn't know exactly where. We missed bottom 4.16 by about 2 days.
It may come back again. Right?
Yeah.
And if you, the deal for you is going to be to not refinance to 4.1%, which isn't going to really change much for you.
Right.
The deal is going to be, can you afford a 15-year mortgage at 3.5% or 3.25%?
Yeah.
And if you can afford that, that changes the game for you, because then you go from a 30-year loan to a 15-year loan, and you save 15 years of payments, and you're paying it at a lower interest rate than you are today. And that's where you start to really compound your savings. That's like, I don't know, savings of $50,000 to $75,000 to $80,000 over the life of the loan, maybe even more, depending on how much your loan amount is.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing you want to think about.
The second part of the story, and kind of off on a tangent, just a tad, if you got a spare moment.
Sure.
We're like a lot of other couples, empty nesters, and we'd like to sell our house and get a cluster home somewhere where we could just lock the door and take off wherever we want for a week or two, and we can't do that right now because we've got a pool in the backyard and it's got to be maintained and everything. But, and it's an acre lot out here in northwest Fulton County. So, but we refuse to sell the house, which we think is a great house with the privacy fence and the pool and everything, but we're just not going to take a lower price for it, and we're going to be waiting out the market. And how much longer do you think? Everybody's got opinions, but how long do you think it's going to be before the market ever comes back where we could get, like, what we want out of our house?
Okay, so let me ask you a question. If it's 30 years until your house comes back to the price that you think it's worth, how is that going to change your life?
I guess we'll be old and gray and sitting around the pool enough.
I'm asking you, Jim, because it's possible that it'll come back in 10 years or never. But when you say to me we want to change our lifestyle, you're going to sell this house for less. You're going to buy for less, right? So you make it less than you want. You're going to buy for a whole lot less, right?
Yeah.
So the game is really about, when people, and I'm asked this question all the time. I have to say this is like the number one question. When is the housing market going to come back? And my answer has to be, how are you going to change your answer in your life based on the number I give you? Because I think it's an impossible question, right? I don't know when. I think the housing, and this is the answer I always give, the housing market's going to come back when people have jobs that pay enough to make their mortgage payments, because then demand is going to come back.
Well,
so right now we have growth in this country that is so low, and the number of jobs that are being created is so low that we are still increasing our rolls of unemployment, not decreasing them. We're at 9.1% unemployment officially. We're really more like 17% in this country. You can't have a housing market on 17% unemployment. And
yeah,
the people
they're kind
who are
tied in together, the jobs and the housing market both. So
you bet your bottom dollar they are. And so it could be 30 years till your house comes back to what you think is value. Are you going to put off your retirement plans for 30 years because you're going to get an extra $50,000 on your house?
No, I mean, if we, get to that point where it's just we're ready to sell it no matter what, I guess we do that. But
I want you to think it through, because I want you to have, this is what I call the plan B, right? You have to think about what your options are going to be and what that means for you financially. If you sold today and you took it at today's price, you sell in 10 years, but you get an extra 20%, right? You have to decide how that changes what you're able to do. And I think a lot of people don't think about it strategically. But this is this house is an investment for you. I mean, if you were going to say to me, okay, we're going to refinance to a 15-year, and in 10 years from now, we're going to have mostly paid off this house. So we're going to have a big chunk of money, one way or the other. And our plan is going to be X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
That's a legitimate plan. That's a good plan B. Whereas if property prices pop up sooner, you'll just sell it sooner. But what the goal is to have enough cash. So I would just say to you, sell high, buy high. Sell low, buy even lower.
Okay.
And I think it's a valid thing to think about, because you're nearing retirement. You want to make some changes to your lifestyle. You and your wife want to go lock up your house and move on and enjoy yourselves. And frankly, short of shoveling dirt in the pool, which I don't advise, you can't do that. And so at some point in time, you're going to need to figure out what you want to do and what price you're going to be willing to do it at and how you're going to play it. And I just think that's the kind of thinking you ought to engage in right now so that you are prepared and you have a goal in mind and you can kind of figure it out. Because honestly, I am not so sure that the housing market's going to cooperate. It's 10 before the hour. We've got news, weather, and traffic coming up. Don't forget to pick up today's Atlanta Journal-Constitution. There's a report about digging into the dangers of Metro Atlanta daycare centers. There were 9 children who died at daycare in the last 5 years, and the AJC is going to tell you how. And it's something I think you're going to want to read. 10 before the hour, I'm Elise Blink. You're listening to AM 750, now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Oh, Doctor Who, one of my all-time favorites. Not really so scary for Halloween, but awfully good music anyway. 55 minutes past the hour on a scary Elise Glink show for Halloween, 404-872-0750. So, you know, I wanted to talk about taxing year-end and how to make a little less taxing, but it's a longer, I don't have quite enough time. So we'll do this again next week, and maybe we'll try and get our tax guys on the phone with us to help out as well. Let's see if I can take one more call. Jim joins us on the line from Loganville. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
I've been seeing on TV about people that are being able to make their payments on their home, and but they're in danger of losing them. But Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, come out, what I understand, has a program coming out where they can be, their house can be refinanced at the value, property value as of now. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, okay, so the Home Affordable Refinance Program, President Obama announced a retool of that earlier in the week.
Right.
And there's been a lot of talk about marking down the principal on the loan balance to where the market value is today. To my knowledge, the only lender that's really doing that at the moment is Ocwen, O-C-W-E-N. We started the show talking about them. We end the show. Ocwen is actually doing some of that in a shared. What they're doing is basically creating a shared appreciation mortgage. So if they knock down the value of your house by $50,000, the mortgage, and then you start paying that, you pay it on time, and in 5 years, your house appreciates 10% in value, you'll pay a piece of that back to Ocwen. But the other big lenders aren't doing that just yet, and we haven't seen the final rules and regulations. So if you're counting on that, probably not going to happen. And I would suggest that you, if you're having trouble making your payments, check out makinghomeaffordable.gov, makinghomeaffordable.gov, or give a call to a HUD-certified housing counselor at 888-995-HOPE. 888-995-HOPE. Well, this scary music means it's time for me to go and figure out what I am going to wear for Halloween tomorrow. I hope that everybody has a safe and happy and candy-filled Halloween. If you don't want your kids eating all that sugar, look for a dentist in the area. They typically will buy Halloween candy from kids just to save on the cavities. I hope you have a great week, everybody. Find me online at thinklink.com.